This is the Creative Sports Podcast. My name is Justin Peterson, and joining me are Garrett Wright.
Do you want to tee it, Justin? Do you want me to tee it? How do you want to?
And Brock Rom.
You guys tee me up for whatever, and I can talk. I have no problem with that.
Brock mentioned that he changed jobs during the pandemic, so now that he's had a handful of months on that job, we pepper him with questions and lessons he's learned as an integrator.
All right. You guys ready? Let's go at 7.
I might have been a skosh early. A little anticipatory. Hey, everyone. Welcome to the show. My name is Garrett Wright. I want to start out with a big thank you to APM Music for donating the tracks we use on this podcast. Also, a reminder that this podcast is an extension of the sports creative community on Slack. So if you're hearing this and not a member of that community yet, you should head over to sportscreativeslack.com and sign up for free.
Garrett, I want to start. I want to pick up with your Twitter because you reshared something that I think is super pertinent, and we can get into Brock's new job and background of the integration, but I feel like the point of this tweet is all about the journey. And so you retweeted Lavelle Moten, who is the head coach at North Carolina Central, and it says, "Dear parents, prepare your kids for the journey. Don't try to prepare the journey for the kids. We're so busy trying to give these kids what we didn't have that we forget to give them what we did have." So, you know, we've talked about before with Brock, you know, when he left Notre Dame and took this job as an integrator, it was building a skill set and building up to the point where he could specialize in a couple different ways if he chose to. And so, you know, the journey is the biggest thing to get where you are. And I think, you know, as we dive into Brock's current job now, I think there's probably some things in there where you're still learning quite a bit. Would that be accurate, Brock?
Oh yeah. I mean, yeah. One of the reasons I like, this job, and I like the broadcast industry and the cinematography industry as a whole, is that everything's changing all the time. This is not my dad was a banker all of his life, and there's nothing wrong with being a banker. It's a really good profession. But and I'm sure the banking industry changes all the time, but the changes in the banking industry don't interest me like the changes in the broadcast industry. So I always compare myself to that and think like, man, banking sounds so boring, but like video, that sounds really cool.
Interest rates are changing. I know
interest
that
interest rates are always changing. Well, on the technology side of I look back at it and I think like, what a dumb misconception of a total sector of industry, right? Like that industry is totally interesting from a technical standpoint, right? And it's ever changing all the time, especially on the security side. But my thought process was, I like video. I'm super interested in this, but mostly I'm really interested that it changes all the time. And that's exciting to me. And that's why I like this industry. And I think that's why I really gravitated towards the more technical side of the industry, because it kind of forces me to always learn something new and not just stay stagnant.
Yeah, absolutely. I 100% agree with that. I think that's the thing that's interesting to me as well. I think when we were talking to Dan in one of the last episodes, he was asking us about our challenges at the end of the episode. And that's something that I think will always be a challenge, is how, you know, when you're pushing in technology, when you're trying to push forward with transformation, it's hard to get people to change, and it's hard to continue to push the boundaries of what's possible, and also, you know, have other stakeholders that are involved too, and making sure that you're not just grabbing at straws trying to do something that maybe doesn't make sense at that given time.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
So I guess starting out with your job, can we get a broad overview of once you land a client, there's got to be some level of what content creators might call pre-production before you get into the production, and setting things up, making sure that you have the plan in place before you actually go in to execute. Can you give us a little background on what that might look like?
Sure. A lot of times, you know, the process for, you know, I'm just going to say a sports venue, right? It is a lot of times there's a design consultant on the job, and they're giving you a loose spec. It's more than a loose spec. It's a lot more than that. They're giving you a spec of what could go in the room, where, signal flow, things like that, right? And you kind of build and design a system based on that and build a bid based on that. And there's a lot of factors there, right? Because you want to make sure the price is good for the client, right? You're obviously competing with other integration companies. You want to make sure, you know, that you want to win a bid, right? But you don't want to cut yourself short in a lot of areas on the design. You got to make sure it's right, because you can't get in on a system and realize, oh, we missed something, or we missed something that was in the consultant spec that we happened to neglect or something like that. So I call that, you call it pre-production, we call it the design phase, right? And there's a lot of design phase. And a lot of that you are sussing out signal flows and workflows, signal paths, file-based workflows, basically the ins and outs of the plant, and making sure that everything is going to work with everything the way you want it to. And make sure the signal requirements are there, the standards requirements are there, the delivery requirements are there. And that's a lot of, time on the front end. And you don't always win all those jobs, right? You can put a ton of front end time on a job, and not win the job. But you hope all that time you put in, you learn something and you can transfer it to the next job you're bidding, right? So
what's it, when we talk signal flow, are you talking, you're talking video, you're talking audio, you also everything. Mentioned files, like
everything, network, video, audio, you name it.
What's the biggest challenge when it comes to the different kinds of flow? You're just trying to make sure everything aligns.
Well, if you're working in a baseband plant, yeah, you're making sure a lot of things align. You're making sure you have the IO where you need it. You're making sure, you know, everything accepts the standards you want across the board, whether you're running your plant in 1080i, 1080p, 4K, what have you. If you're talking IP, there's a lot more that goes into it, and a lot more interoperability based on standards on things like NMOS between vendors, in-band, out-of-band control, when you're whether or not, you know, what is flipping to traditional baseband and what's flipping back and where all that's going. Are you hitting patch panels with that? Are you not? IP has a lot more design work on the front end than a traditional baseband system. But it's everything. And I think one of the biggest things, the number one thing I'll say about the job is it's not an easy job. And that's not me sitting here saying, oh, I do a really hard job. It's a very challenging job. And I'm not sitting here saying I'm great at it. But that's kind of the reason I took it, is because it's extremely challenging. I used to be I knew how everything worked in video, right? But I very much so just made things work, right? Where there is an element to this job, and it's probably it is the most important element, which is the documentation element, right? So like I would, in the field, just make things work, hook it up. I would dress the cables nice, right? But I wasn't creating AutoCAD drawings, you know, based on that, and documentation based on that, cable numbers, right? And now a lot of that work has to be done on the front end, and you're designing, and you have to do this, you're designing a fully working system before you ever get into the plant. That's not saying you're not going to have issues, or you're not going to figure things out or change things and redline things on the job site. But the amount of time, you put way more time, I'm not going to say this for every job, but you put a ton of time on the front end, making sure your documentation is right, doing all what we call pre-wire, right? I build all my cables, or we build as many cables as we can in our shop before we go out on site, but I have every cable documented before we go out on site. And that's numbered. They're all in spreadsheets. They're all in flow drawings. Our rack elevations are all built in AutoCAD, all of our console elevations, and everything has to be very specific and very particular. And it really takes a type A personality. And if you know me, I'm not a type A personality at all. So I kind of have to force myself to be more organized with that stuff, because I'm more of a traditional get out in the field. It doesn't work. I can make it work. It doesn't matter. Like I will figure out a way to make it work, or I'll engineer a way around to make it work. But there is some of that in this job, but a lot of it is you got to make it work beforehand. You have to document how it all works. You have to submit all that and get it approved before it works. And it has to be very official. The other thing you have to worry about is budget constraints for your client. You know, you're always trying to, you know, it's a lot of it's our jobs to have the client's best interests in mind, right? So if there are ways we find in value engineering to save them money, things like that, yeah, this is a better product that does this, but do they really need it? And we have that discussion with them and with the consultant and say, you know, we might be able to save a few bucks here. We might be able to save a few bucks here, whether that's on integration costs or equipment costs.
I'm having flashbacks of watching some HGTV where there's a big renovation and then they find something that's wrong, and they come back to the owner like, okay, well, we can cut some money here and here so that we can make this foundational thing happen, because without the foundation, you're not going to have a house, right? Like,
right.
I guess that's kind of what I'm hearing.
The beauty is we make sure the foundation's right, right? You know, some things you might have to throw a converter in here or there, right? Or something like that on site that you didn't realize, oh, we need another fiber to SDI converter here, right? Those are no big deal type things that just happen on the site. Or we do a lot of cable moves. We call them R&Rs, relocate and relabel, right? Where we thought a cable was going to go here, it was going to work here, it doesn't really, we're going to move it, we're going to relabel it, we're going to relocate it. We have to document all of that. And the other thing that's difficult about this job, and the thing that I still learn every single day, is I do not have an electrical engineering degree, and I don't think you have to for this job, but man, does it help sometimes in doing things like power drawings, right? Or heat load calculations in rooms. There's a little bit of electrical engineering in a lot of like little hidden places that I don't, you know, I don't totally know, because I'm not an electrical engineer. I try really hard every day to try and be one, but I'm not. But I know the broadcast side really, really well, and hopefully that makes up for it a little bit. And we have really, really smart electrical engineers on staff that I can always ask really dumb questions to, and they never say they're dumb questions, even though I know they are. But I know how to get the right answer a lot of the time. And you also have to know a little bit about construction, and that's tough, because like, you're coming from a background of like, I've worked in broadcast. I know nothing about construction, right? I know nothing about general contractors and subcontractors and how those relationships work. But that's a big part of this job is going in, and you need to, draw like your power layout for the room, right? You need to give technical power drawings with notes and everything to an actual electrical engineer who's the master electrician on the job, right? And you want to make sure they're not calling you being like, are you dumb? Why'd you do this? I haven't had that happen yet. But on top of that, you need to be able to walk in a room and see what's wrong, because it happens sometimes on a job. You know, you get into a brand new construction or a renovated room, and you're looking at your drawing and you're looking at what they built, and it doesn't line up, right? And you need to be able to point that out and be able to say, this isn't quite right, we're not quite right here. And on top of that, you need to be on calls beforehand to make sure those things are sussed out, so the room is what you want it to be power wise. So, it's a job where you got to know a little bit about a lot of things. And it's hard to have that mix of skills. I definitely didn't come in having that mix of skills. I knew one side of it very well, which is the broadcasting side and the sports side and the operational side of things. How signal flow worked, things like that. But the everything else is it's there's a lot of learning, right? And I'm very fortunate to be surrounded by a lot of very smart people who have done this for years, who I get asked questions to. But yeah.
You know, I was kind of going to get to the relationship side of this, because obviously in creating content and production and what I do, like, relationships are key and building those are key. But when you're bouncing around to different jobs, like, you talk about needing to go into a room and be able to like see what might be wrong, or like, you know, the talk to the vendors and the contractors, subcontractors, like, how much are you able to build relationships with some of these people and like get to know, you know, them as people that might help this? And how much is it like, I'm just working with different people all the time and I'm kind of out here on my own to learn it?
You can build relationships, right? Like, there's totally, you could work with a GC project manager on a different job someplace else, right? And again, I haven't done this for more than a year, and you got to think I've done like 2.5 jobs in a year, which is usual like timeline, right? So you're only doing so many jobs a year. You only have that many time to meet that many. When you have that much time to meet that many deadlines. A lot of it is you have to build those relationships in the short amount of time you're on a job, right? Because, and they can't be combative, right? Because everybody has to help everybody, right? I'm always going to need something from the GC or the electrician or something like
general
that.
General contractor. So,
right.
GC.
Right. And I don't know how other integration companies work because I don't work for them. But at Beck, we don't have project managers or anything like that who interface with the client. It's all our engineers, right? In my understanding, that's a little bit rare, but you have to have people skills too, and be able to build that relationship with the GC, the consultant, the client, you know, and make sure everybody's, you know, on the same page. Cause at the end you have very, very important deadlines to hit. And you have to do things the right way and you have to do it right the first time. And there's not a ton of margin for error. So making sure that people are on the same page together, is extremely important, and kind of the crux of the whole job. So you have to, the relationships are key. You just have to build them in very short amount of times. Now on the vendor side, you build very strong relationships because you're working with a lot of the same sales, a lot of the same commissioning staff. So that's extremely helpful, right? You get a lot of those folks on speed dial, when you have issues, right? Or, you know, you're trying to get something set up. That's really helpful. And then obviously you build good relationships with your clients, because the clients are so extremely important, right? And you build years long relationships with clients because you don't just want somebody to be your client for one job. You want them to be your client for life, right? You want them to say, oh, Brock did such a good job on our room and managing and engineering this project. We'd want to do it again with him, right? And that's important, even though that again might be 8 to 10 years down the road. That's
or they
important.
Recommend you to somebody else who's going right, through exactly. it, or they hear about it. It's word of mouth type stuff. Yeah,
it's a totally relationship-based business model across the board, and so they're extremely important.
Going back a little bit, you talked about, you know, the venue having a design consultant that maybe kind of gives you a base of what to work off of when you get, you know, that plan as you get ready to make the bid. Like, how much information do you have? What is in that consultant's, you know, report or whatever that you're given, and how much of it are you kind of on your own to figure out, you know, the holes in that?
Right. I think, you know, I think people need to understand the role a consultant plays in a large project. And it's not just, hey, we're consulting on this video production control room, right? Because we know a lot about video production control rooms, but what they really do is they integrate all the systems together. So front of house sound system, LED boards, IPTV, AV, anything throughout, like they're all of those systems have to interop, right? And we only do one section of it. We do video production control rooms. That's what we do. We do video production control rooms, broadcast trucks, broadcast TV, and broadcast control rooms. That's what we do. We don't do, you know, front of house sound systems. We don't do IPTV. We don't do general AV. We are very, very specialized. So the consultant's main job is to design all those systems and design them in a way that they're going to be able to interop and work together with multiple different companies and making sure it all comes together right. So you get a design and it's pretty well done. There are options. It doesn't just come out and say, you know, here's what you use, here's how you use it, right? But there's a general spec, and we build to that. And usually there's questions that go back and forth on the spec. And a lot of times that spec is worked out with the client ahead of time, so the client has a lot of say on it. But then we have to take those solutions and integrate them together, right? And we have to make sure that we're coordinating with other trades as well to make sure, hey, I'm handing off, you know, 6 pathways to an IPTV encoder. What rack are those in? What termination do they need to be? Do your standards match our standards? Which they should be, because they should be building off of the consultant spec, right? Which identifies all that, but sometimes it doesn't. Sometimes things slip through the crack, right? You know, things that are out of our spec a lot of times are LED boards, something like a Daktronics or something like that, right? And we have to interop with them on a lot of different ways, whether that's handing off feeds back and forth, data back and forth between all sport controllers, control to trigger stuff, right? And we have to make sure all that interops and works. Front of house audio, same thing. Are we using Dante? Are we using analog ties? Are we using Maddie back and forth? How are we getting IO back and forth? What are we calling it? You know, so yeah, there's a, but again, we always look in those phases too to figure out, you know, from our experience of building rooms, hey, where can we save some money? Where can we, you know, make things maybe a little bit more efficient, you know, because we're installing rooms constantly and we see a lot of this stuff in practice. So we generally have a good, you know, idea of what's out there, what's new, what can be, you know, substituted in certain places.
Well, and once you get the job, you know, you kind of talk about, you know, maybe that flexibility off what the original plan was. How much, you know, how rigid is a plan usually, and how much are you flexing once you're on site?
I mean, in the end, it's the client, you know, sets a standard of what they need, right? And they really, you know, work with the consultant to suss out a plan that really fits all their needs. Now, with that being said, there's totally times we go in and somebody says, like, you know what, it'd be really great to have more IO right here on this bench. Can you guys put in an IO panel and have this extra, you guys have extra router space? And it's like, yeah, we can totally do that. Those are things that happen all the time, or they'll say, you know what, I really don't like this here. Now that I see it in person, I want to move it here. Those things happen with the client all the time. But to me, a big part of it is just having the client involved as early as possible and have as much say as they want to have say during the integration and commissioning portion is extremely helpful, right? Because in the end, it's not my room. I'm not going to be the one running that room. I could set up the room exactly how I would want to run it. But that doesn't mean that the person coming in is going to want to run it that way, right? So it's extremely important to have the client involved as much as possible and give them as much say as possible in things, on how you name things, how you set things up, how you commission, how you do certain things. Cause in the end, they're the ones who are going to take over and use that room when you get out of there. Cause once we're done and we're done with our event support and everything, we're done, we're out, you know. Still stay in touch with our clients. We still do a lot of phone calls back and forth, but at the end, they're the ones who have to run the room on a day-to-day basis. So I know that doesn't directly answer your question, but it kind of, you know, it kind of gives you a little bit of perspective behind that.
You were talking about the IO adjustments there and, you know, adding more power to a room. And as you were talking about the heat load earlier as well, my mind kind of went to building a PC, because that's essentially what you're doing, right? You're trying, I mean, not necessarily like in a vacuum, I guess, but, you're trying to lay out a room, and how much of it is refrigerated, a lot of back end cooling where all of that happens? Are you putting a lot of the IO back there? The heat load part was just really interesting to me because that's what it automatically made me think of building a PC.
Right. Yeah. And the principles of the dynamics of airflow are essentially the same. And a lot of times in larger builds, and especially in venues, is you'll have spec'd a hot aisle and a cold aisle, right? And you'll separate those. Usually by a third party company comes in and builds hot aisle, cold aisle with a door on it and plasticking. And basically it's exactly what you think it is. It's here's the hot aisle, here's the cold aisle, and the cold air pulls through to the hot aisle to cool the equipment, right? But there's a lot of load calculations that go in. You estimate what your maximum you know, heat could be in a room if everything's running absolutely at max, which it never does, right? But you want to account for it, right? And then you want to make sure you have the certain amount of tons of air cooling and movement. A lot of times that's crack units between racks. Sometimes there's larger just units that feed like up through the floor. You know, if you're like in a traditional data center, a lot of that air comes up through the floor above the racks and then exhausts up towards the top. So a lot of it depends on the room, the design of the room, and how that's all working. But airflow is completely is very, very critical. You know, I remember in Kansas City, we had some airflow issues on a really old room. because some HVAC had been changed after the room was initially built, and some returns, like the send and the return, got moved right next to each other. So the air was literally just coming in and going right back out. So the room didn't cool very well anymore. And it caused equipment to overheat. So, you know, it's extremely important. But the nice thing is on renovations and new builds, a lot of that is really well accounted for, right? And you don't have to worry about as much except for saying, here's what's our potential heat load, right? And, you know, from there, there's a separate trade, you know, that handles the HVAC system or the spot cool, the crack units, things like that. It's not something you want to get wrong, right? But the nice thing is on a renovation or a new build, a lot of it gets taken into account early on. So,
yeah, it's a lot of math. I saw Garrett's eyes glossing over a little bit there for a second.
It is, but it's also just a lot of spreadsheets, right? Like you do the same equations over and over and over again, right? And you just put in, you can build spreadsheets and equations that just do the calculation for you, right? It's good to understand the basis behind that calculation because you want to know if your calculation's wrong, right? And if you're getting a really wild number. But like I was just on a site survey today, you know, retrofitting an existing room, an existing data room that already had UPSs in it. And we had to figure out, okay, these UPSs are, you know, so many KVAs, you know, and what are we going to put in here? Are the existing enough? Yeah, we think they're enough. Same with the cooling, things like that. So, I mean, you kind of got to just do some napkin math when you're out in the field, you know, on the back of your hand and just kind of figure out if you're there or if your margins are razor thin, then you can go back and do a real calculation, add more, make sure you have overhead, things like that. But that, you know, I don't want to dwell on that because that's like such a small part of the job, but it is part of the job. But I think it's a really good indicator of how varied this job is, and what you need to know and how you need to apply it. Cause let me tell you what, a lot of the job is traditional. Just like, here's a system, we're standing it up, just make it work. Right? Like, and you run into the same issues every engineer runs into. It's just like, this isn't working. It was working yesterday. It's not working today. What changed? What happened? You know, or this isn't
powered off, power it back on and it's back working. Right.
Happens sometimes, right? You do that sometimes. But yeah, it's still a lot of, I remember there are some PTZs on a job one time that like, I could not get to work with an in-house IT, switch infrastructure. There was some incompatibility there and getting that to work and, you know, playing middleman between the two vendors to try and get them to work together, to try and get it figured out, you know, like those types of things happen are still a large part of the job.
How do you go about, you know, even like gaining this knowledge? Like I know you well enough to kind of know just your background and that you've slowly gained it. And we've talked before that like, this is a skill set that's in need. You know, that there are jobs out there to do what you're doing right now that are, you know, going unfilled. Like, how do you go about gaining this knowledge? What was it for you that kind of sparked your interest and like shot you into this line?
To me, it was when I started at Husker Vision and Mike Hodges and Scott Guthrie, and we used to do basic training with Mike Hodges, where he would show us the basics of everything from video, right? And I remember him walking through things and being like, I don't want to just know the steps to make something work. I want to know why we're taking those steps to make it work. And I was very lucky. Mike and Scott and everybody at Husker Vision was very willing to show me, right? And give me a real background on how it worked and why it worked that way. And they didn't really have to do that, but they did. And then on top of that, I had students at Notre Dame ask me all the time, like, how did you learn all this stuff? And it's 100% true. I've been screwed by all of it before, right? Like it's all catastrophically went wrong for me before. And then you figure out how to fix it. And then you never forget it. You always remember, you know, these little things that just accumulate in your mind. And then one problem can morph itself to help solve another problem. Maybe this problem is like this problem. And then you go and solve that problem. So yeah, everything I've learned has been something that has totally screwed me, taken me off air, screwed something up for me before that I figured out. And you just say in the back of your mind, you make a mental note and you say, oh, I'm never going to let that happen again. You know, and you go from there.
For you at Notre Dame, I mean, you were in charge of people, you had students. How do you teach them to care about this stuff? Like it's such a technical, intense thing that like, Is it just you have to pick the ones that already care about it, or how do you get kids into it that may not have that passion yet?
Yeah, I think you're right. I think, you know, you have to find the kids who want to learn and don't just want to go through the motions to get to the end product. And there's nothing wrong with that. There's nothing wrong with wanting to know, hey, what buttons do I press to get from here to there? You know, if you're an editor and you just want to get your job done, or you're a shooter, or, you know, a TD, you know, you don't necessarily need to know all the ins and outs, right? And there's nothing wrong with that. But, you know, going back to when I started at Husker Vision with Mike Hodges and Scott Guthrie and those guys, when I was learning, I wasn't satisfied with just pushing the buttons. I had to know what the buttons did. And finding those kids, to that have that same passion and want to have that same understanding conceptually of how things work, that those kids are rare. And I'm not totally sure why that is. I think it's because kids who are kind of have that critical thinking are usually going into computer science nowadays, or some sort of higher level engineering, right? That sort of logical problem solving skill. Not saying that I have that by any stretch of the imagination. I'd be a terrible software engineer or anything like that. But I think that skill is a little bit more transferable to a lot of different professions now. And those kids aren't necessarily maybe going into TV. You know, I'm not totally sure, but when you do find those kids, you kind of got to hold on to them because it's special. And if you're listening to this, I think having that attitude, even if you don't intend on being an engineer, even if you don't intend on being on the technical side full time, I think having that curiosity and being able to put yourself in a position to solve those technical problems logically is only going to help you in your career.
Well, thank you so much for making Creative Sports Podcast part of your day. We'd love to hear your thoughts, feedback, and suggestions, so pop on over to the Sports Creative Community on Slack and connect with us and your fellow creatives. If you're enjoying this podcast, we'd love it if you shared it with a friend or a coworker, and leave us a 5-star rating so other people will be able to find us as well. And don't forget to subscribe so that you're the first person to catch each new episode. Remember, the world needs your voice, so keep creating.